Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we have a very special guest, Larry Nemechek. And he will be joining us in a little bit to discuss Jonathan Frakes' work as a director. But before we get into that, let's talk about Discovery and more casting news.
More casting, more peoples for Star Trek Discovery.
Three more people. Malik Pancholi is confirmed now, which I think we all knew already. Mm-hmm. And then he's going to be playing the doctor of the Shenzhou, right?
Yes.
Then We've got Terry Serpico, who's going to be playing a Starfleet admiral. And let me see, they always have one name,
Bartholomeos.
Okay, there you go, Sam.
I'm locking in on that one, Sam. Okay. Bartholomeos.
Okay, I'm going to call him Sam. Yes. He's going to play an ensign on the Shenzhou, who's out of Starfleet Academy, or as they say, at an ensign from Starfleet Academy. I don't know, you know. I don't know how accurate.
He's a junior officer.
Yes. And, You know, here's the thing about this, right? The thing which I think is really kind of crazy is, like, we really haven't been introduced to many crew members on Discovery itself, right?
Or have we?
I mean, yeah. Are they going to do? I mean, you were talking about this off mic. Maybe there's a Voyager thing going on where,
right, something bad happens. Discovery gets in the mix, and they got to figure out what happened, and that's where the Klingons come into the time, you know, into the storyline. Is they got to work together because they got to figure out what happened to the Shenzhou, And maybe somebody from the Shenzhou is, you know, going to be coming over, and you know, I sense that something's going to happen to the Shenzhou just with all of this. And at least one of these people is going to wind up on the Discovery, because otherwise I don't know if they would tell us their names. Unless they tell the Shenzhou story in like flashback as they're tracking things down or something.
Or this is some sort of massive, you know, longest day type of series, which has like 15,000 plot lines going on at once, and it's like, you know, which I'm totally okay with, right?
Oh, same here. Yeah, no, the more the merrier, so far as that's concerned.
Whatever it is, it's going to be crazy, and I'm excited.
Yeah, you know, it's always good to get Star Trek in the news is a good thing. There's nothing necessarily splashy with casting news like this, but it's something. It's signs of progress and building towards something that's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. So it's cool. I'm excited. I'm you know, the more I hear about you know, the people who are coming involved, the more excited I get. It seems like a very diverse cast. But yeah, so it's exciting. Yeah, and hey. There's going to be Klingons. We saw some Klingons online. That's cool, right?
And there was a very spirited debate about that, about, you know, the Klingons, quote unquote, not looking right. It's like, you know, they change every so often. I mean, Worf's head changed how many times just in Next Generation, for Pete's sake? Let's just all say their heads evolve. Done. See, we're out.
With that. I mean, on the long list of things I'm worried about with this show, how the Klingons look is pretty much at the very bottom. I have to say.
Well, I mean, why would it be also out of the realm of possibility that there would be variants among the Klingons?
Yeah.
You know, like maybe there's somebody from the southern end of Kronos that looks a little different or something like that. I'm down with that too.
Sure. Why not? Yeah. All right. Well, okay, just one other thing that I want to mention, not related to Discovery, but in terms of the news. They started up the Kickstarter thing, or the Indiegogo thing, for this this Deep Space Nine documentary, which Ira Stephen Bear has been working on for like 5 years now, called What We Left Behind. And they hit their goal in the first day. They've hit their second stretch goal now, which means they're only $100,000 away from hitting the second stretch goal, which means, expanded writer's room segment. So
which
come
is
on,
exciting.
Guys. Yes, let's make this happen because you know what?
There is obviously a hunger for more Deep Space Nine behind the scenes stuff. You know, I mean, for them to make their initial goal in a day, there's definitely some interest out there, I'd say.
For sure. And there's that one like shot in that little teaser thing where you see Ron Moore talking about how they're going to get like Sisko back on the station. I'm like, oh my God, is this heaven?
Yep.
Oh my God, I can't wait. This is easily my most anticipated film of 2018 right now. So yeah, head on over to their Indiegogo thing and check that out. Okay, well, should we get into our feature presentation for today?
Yes, feature presentation.
And now our feature presentation.
Hey, it's Larry Nemechek. How's it going, Larry?
It's going good. It's going good. It was very hard for me to... I was trying to stay out of your Discovery discussion there, but...
No, see, you shouldn't have stayed out. We want your take. We've got...
We are...
Well,
you know, yes.
I was expecting like an iron curtain-ribbed like airlock door here between the segments, and we just kind of oozed... We just kind of did an Odo under the door there and just oozed in, so...
You know, anything goes here on Stage 9. You've been
That's
on
right.
Stage 9, or whatever number it is
I
these
have,
days.
Or Paramount 31 or 30, whatever the hell it is. Yeah.
Whatever it is,
Unless it's new Stage 9, which is Stage 9.
No, not that one. No, we're on
the
original
real one.
Stage
And then there's
nine
the Stage 9 It Continues sets, but which is what the sets have been christened. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah, I want to go there so bad.
Because when I first saw your name changed, I thought, now, I don't know, this is going to be a podcast all about Continues? That was different, but okay. It could just about support one, but...
Pretty much, yeah. But no, yeah. So, welcome to the show. You haven't been on our new show yet, which is kind of weird.
I haven't, but I can still smell the new paint smell. It's great in here. And
We're still moving the bigger set pieces in.
Yeah. But I love what you've done with the fireplace. That's nice. And
it was an important innovation.
Right next to the helm console. So it's all good. Yeah. I just wanted to say real quick that all the spec. Yeah, when you said about Discovery being in the news and that's the best thing ever, it is. And I mean, I can't wait for Star Trek. I've said this a million times. I can't wait for Star Trek to break through as this 13-part, all access, new universe, new paradigm of production. You know, called the streaming channels and the premium channels and all that. And for Star Trek to finally jump into that, and for it to be some little cult, not to the fandom but to the mainstream, some cult show that breaks through, and every fourth person at all the Comic-Cons next year is wearing some obscure, you know, our hero costume that's really distinctive from Discovery. That would be the awesomest thing ever. But I'll be happy with less. I'm happy with a good show. But I have this little fantasy in my mind that.
We'll make the every fourth person dressing up as the stretch goal. And our initial goal is just a good show.
Well, the DS9 documentary, I mean, I had no doubts, but the fact they made their goal in one or whatever 1 or 2 days was just incredible. I was going to call up Ira to do an interview or something, and I only had to. I love it when the Kickstarter campaigns zoom ahead of anything anybody can do from the outside. That's a great sign. That's a great sign. But Discovery, I think, is going to be the storytelling, partly because it was Brian creating it, dreaming it up, and partly because it's just freaking 2017, and that's where TV is. Cutting-edge TV, I think it'll be, I don't know about, you know, millions of ships and crews, but I think it'll be, it's not a 26-episode run at 7 years, we need a standing crew that things happen to. You know, they go, and that drives all the action. And over time, we get maybe 5 or 10 or 15 recurring characters. This is a big splash debut, limited season, returning seasons. But it'll be like an epic movie. It'll be like Game of Thrones or The Sopranos or whatever, where you definitely have your regulars, but you've got a whole fleshed out cast, and everybody will be proud to be a part of it. And if that means two ships and a Klingon ship and a base, and you know, I mean, it's not going to be limited. Like, where does our hero ship go every episode? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So this doesn't surprise me. I mean, it is. in the beginning, it is, okay, now, is that on the Shinzu or is that on Discovery? I mean, you know, he's the second assistant janitor prop guy. Okay, which ship is he on? That'll be a little dicey in the beginning, but yeah. And I love the fact that we finally come to the era of the leaks, so.
Yep. Yeah, this show has been rather... maybe it hasn't. Maybe it hasn't been any leakier than any other production. It's just that people are paying attention. I don't know.
I think it's been relative. I mean, there's just been one or two that get a real high profile. No, it hasn't been. It's not near as leaky as Trump's White House, but but
true.
But it's just been enough to make everybody go. And you know. So anyway, that's not our theme tonight, so we shouldn't keep talking about it. But it's fun to watch this and to know that, oh my God, it won't premiere for another 4, 5, or 6 months. So. Look out, leak!
Yeah.
Look out, more leaks, and you know, CBS still hasn't confirmed that. Yeah. What's her name? Shaniqua. Yeah, they've still not officially confirmed that because they're going by the official PR playbook of announcements. So,
yeah, which means, I'm guessing that when she's announced, there's going to be another wave of, you know, people like her captain. You know, I mean, we still don't know the captain of Discovery, right? So yeah.
Unless there isn't one and she's like the acting captain and they've done all that to fool you. No, she's not Khan. No, don't. Not at all.
Yeah, I don't know.
That one left deep scars for all of us, Larry. That was definitely oof.
Oh well. So today we're going to be talking about something which is kind of inspired by some, you know, speculation regarding Discovery, and that is Jonathan Frakes as a director and his work in Star Trek and outside of Star Trek, but primarily inside of Star Trek, because it's a very sort of unique story, and in a lot of ways that he's probably the most famous director of the Next Generation era. And the stuff that he's done has been really good, you know, starting all the way back in season 3 of Next Gen with The Offspring and going into the movies with First Contact and Insurrection and then past the movies into a career which he's been able to maintain for, what, like 20 years now, right? Which is really impressive. Mm. I mean, that's like his thing. He's not even really an actor anymore so much as he is a director. And that's really cool. So, figured bring on Larry, talk about some Frakes and see where this goes. So, okay. He got his start. Everyone knows that he like went to the directing school. You know, he was kind of the pioneer in that regard. But, you know, I mean, you do hear about actors on TV shows directing, you know, episodes of their shows every once in a while. I mean, you know, Shatner directed episodes of T.J. Hooker. He was going to do an episode of the original series, apparently, if it hadn't ended as quickly as it had. And I'm guessing that that's a fairly common thing, but it seemed to be like a really big deal on Next Gen. Like, this isn't something that Berman was just going to hand to people. They had to work for it. So what was the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, well, the show had settled in. The first 2 years were so chaotic, as we all, and now is out in public, but, you know, the Chaos in the Bridge documentary. But, yeah, Jonathan had wanted that. I think he was, by that time... How do I say this? I think he knew, just like Robin McNeil, that he had loved acting, but in college and all that, you know, the guys that have a look about them know that they won't always have that look their whole life. And if part of that is their casting appeal, not to get, you know, weird about it, but it's the same thing happens to women. In fact, it's just a good security thing in Hollywood. Basically, any actor knows that if they're hot when they're 18 and 20 and 22 and 25, first all you concentrate on is just getting work, right? And if you can break through to being past a working actor to where you're a known working actor, and then you're a type and a known and you're cast, heaven forbid you're like a constant, that guy we always see or that woman we always see, we can't remember their name. And then if you ever like really get a break and you're a lead in a hit show or you break through in a movie, that's awesome. And then, you know, every time the challenge and your paranoia shifts from, you know, can I not starve to can I keep doing this without having to have a day job, to can I, oh, now I'm a hit, now can I keep up, or will I be a one-hit wonder? And then it, then eventually, if you're working regularly, or if you're, a, you know, A, if you're a huge iconic kick like you played Riker on Next Generation, your first worry is, will I be stereotyped? Like the original cast all felt like they were, and always were fighting against, until they just gave up and became icons and could live off that. And then and then it's, what's my second, what's my follow-up going to be? That's what you're paranoid about. What's my paranoid going to be to show that I wasn't just, you know, Riker, that I can do something else. And that's hard for a lot of people. Even the, you know, the best actors on Trek that we all love. I mean, it's not their fault. Sometimes, you know, you're a victim of your success. Like, I think maybe Brent was that way. And I mean, in the original cast, surely Shatner and Nimoy were that way even at the beginning. They would do bits, but nothing was going to, you know, playing Paris on Mission Impossible was not going to live up to being Spock. And you know, Barbary Coast sure was no Kirk for Shatner. So, I mean, that's, but this is all the creative's mental hurdles that you get through. And if you are lucky enough, if you do get to be a Denny Crane after years of being Shatner or nothing, I mean, a Kirk or nothing, then you've got to a plateau, you know? And the way a lot of actors hedge that, very good actors, even the ones that become iconic, is they look around and they go, well, I, you know, what's not going to depend on my looks? And it's not about them and their internal confidence and their talent. The talent doesn't go away, but you're dealing in Hollywood the way you are maybe in the political realm. You're dealing with perceptions, right? And the people that have the money, the suits, the hiring people, the decision makers. And you could be the best in the world, but if there's a meme or something that's running through and you're on the wrong side of the meme, then there's very little you can do about it. That's why I love the people that were big hits and then they go away and you hear they were, like, you know, caught, arrested, raiding a dumpster or something, you know, 20 years later. And then 10 years go by and they're cast in something that's a huge hit and everybody goes, oh, what a great comeback so-and-so just had, you know? It's like, well, it's not like that's, are they any less talented than they were when they were, you know, younger? So yeah. It's all about all those external things. So one of the things you do to control the externals is you go to the places where there's still a lot of competition and you still have to be competent and talented, but the cosmetic factors aren't there. A lot of actors, that's why a lot of actors do voiceover. A lot of actors go into, because that's the craziest, wickedest, meanest realm of all of a job. And a lot of them, you know, they become producers, they become directors. And if they're smart, they do it when they can leverage themselves when they're at the top of their peak, you know, as actor, which shows how smart Jonathan and other, like Roxanne and Robbie, and a lot of them that go, you know, I'm not going to be 20 and sparkling my whole life. And sadly, that's where the prejudice of the money, the casting, and the pop and the public also is. So you want that dependable day job, even though it's not. You have to get hired a million times, you know, you have to get hired over and over again, but you... If you show your talent and you have a network of people that will probably have you back, and new things are coming along all the time that are looking for that, then it's very, like we talked about, a lot of actors have no intention of giving up acting, but they like to direct to kind of stretch their muscles. I mean, Patrick's directed,
yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. and no one's not going to think of him as a director over an actor, but yeah, so it's just that John of the Star Trek world. Jonathan was, James Darren did the same thing. When Jimmy Darren grew out of his Moondoggy years and his teen pop years in the 80s, he directed on T.J. Hooker, much less other things.
Yeah.
And he never thought he'd be back in front of a camera, really, until you know, Ira and the DS9 guys found him after Frank Sinatra Jr. didn't want to do it, to be Vic. And then that, in turn, got him thinking about singing again, and he started touring for singing and in his act. So, you know, things go in cycles. But it's a logical thing. Jonathan was the first one to break through, and it helped that Next Generation finally was calming down, you know, with Michael there, because the Offspring was the first one. And they used to talk about Star Trek directing college, and Rick would make him go sit with the editors and with the, you know, the effects guys and see how all the parts worked. But, you know, Jonathan is a smart guy, partly shown by the fact that it was only the third season of Next Gen when he was thinking about the future. So
yeah. Now, I mean, like, you hear him describe the you know, directing college or whatever it was, and it sounds very intense for him. And then everyone else, once he did it, you know, everyone else kind of followed. And, you know, you look at sort of like when the other, you know, actors sort of like fell in place, and they're kind of like one right after the other. And I kind of get the impression that
LeVar is another one.
Right, for sure. But I kind of get the impression that, like, once he got through that door, that they kind of eased up on everyone else. I mean, that's just, I'm not basing that on anything other than just, you know, my personal, you know, perception of that. But I mean, would you say that that's accurate?
You mean, like, did he knock down the wall? Did he pioneer it for everybody else? Yeah.
Well, like did Berman say, like, okay, I'll let you do this, but if you do it, you're going to have to put in, you know, like 100 hours in the editing room, and you're going to have to do all this stuff. By the time Patrick Stewart came around, he's like, okay, just sit with the editor for a day, and then we'll say, you know, you're that's good enough. You know.
Well, I mentioned LeVar. So LeVar is another one who everybody remembers. I mean, he's blessed because he hits the world as Kunta Kinte in Roots. And just a few years before Next Generation. So, because when they were, you know, when they announced, we were talking about Discovery a while ago, and on the way modern TV and where they'll, on big projects, they'll like drag it out for the social media value, you know. In the old days, the 80s and 90s and aughts, you know, remember how they would just come out and announce everybody. Here's the cast picture, you know, Next Gen did that and DS9. Yeah. Okay. And because no one cared, and there was only three networks and one, you know, Entertainment Tonight and newspapers and magazines, and nobody needed a drip, drip, drip. But when they announced the Next Gen cast, I distinctly remember, I've got the clipping. It was, oh, Next Generation is headed by LeVar Burton of Roots, Will Wheaton of Stand By Me, and this very famous British Shakespearean guy who was in Dune, and I, Claudius.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, and then some other people. And that was because they didn't care about the character billing order. They were talking about their actual, you know, marquee value, clout. So LeVar was really lucky that he kind of got over that, he had Kunta, and then he transformed that into Reading Rainbow, which at the time was, oh, that little PBS show. But, you know, you influence this whole generation that now are all running the world. So he's God to that generation. And then he's Geordi. So he's very blessed to do that. But even he, not knowing that Reading Rainbow would come back and we'd have social media and you could, you know, do a million different platforms with it, and knowing that he was never going to be as young as Kunta again, and then he would not be as young as Geordi again, and the movies were only going to go so long, that he was smart in investing in it. And he had that, you know, it's not everybody that has it. Not every actor can be a director. Or be the best director, or be a functioning director that people want to keep rehiring because they deliver a great product, and especially in television, they get the damn thing done on time and on budget, you know, and they're not a diva, and they get along with people, and if there's some added value there, they bring in. That's the key thing that John. I mean, all these Trek people, whether they're infected with the inner glow of the gene of the Roddenberry vision or not, that helps. But that's what television directing and consistent directing is all about. If you break through to features, it's like, oh my God, what was your box office? You know, and that's how much money you'll get for the headliners. Yeah. And then if you don't get those, then are you just a working features director and you go out and you do, you know, indie movies? And, you know, because there's a whole layer to that. There's a whole pecking order to that. And we only think about the really top name, top dollar, high blockbuster directors. But there's a whole cadre of working directors that are doing, you know, indie projects and small budget things. So there's that to play with. And these guys that are really looking for the security, because one thing in Hollywood, you never know, you know, nothing is sure. You're always hedging your bets. And the smart ones are the ones that stash the money away. Don't go blow it. So
I imagine that, you know, the fact that he was also successful, you know, out of the gate helped a lot too. Like if he had gone through all of the training and everything, and then he does an episode and it goes sideways, that probably locks everybody else out for a while. Or, you know, possibly Berman just says, no, we're good. We don't need to try this again. So, you know, I would just imagine that natural talent that he has was, you know, it's good that he was one of the first through the door.
And the other big thing about Jonathan, and again, we're talking about the little world of Next Generation. And as you guys know, and as we talk about on Portal 47, all the audience sees is that finished product, and we see a fraction of the names on screen. There's this whole community of 150 people, some of them not all together. There's the stage bunch. There's the people in the offices. Sometimes there's overlap. There's all the post people that may not ever see anybody in the stages in the offices. But there are some people that do have to make the rounds, like, you know, the executive on TV, the executive producer, Rick Berman, has to do that, or the showrunners have to do that. And the show directors, to some extent, are way beyond that, so too. But it starts with the stage, and that's the daily group of people who are, you know, union guys and gals, and they get up, and people are in at 4 a.m, and sometimes they may be there till midnight, and you're balancing all these crews, and you're doing actors, and everybody with their little, on one hand, their little inherent, you know, pecking order leads, regular cast, guest actors, you know, director of photography, design heads when they come in, crew heads, crew guys, stand-in stunt people that if you sneeze or you leak a picture of the Klingons, your name is toast, you know. And see how it all weaves together, guys. It all weaves together. But, you know, you've got that hierarchy spread. And for someone to be able to, get the job done well and endear themselves to so many. I mean, that was basically Jonathan's thing. He was talented. He was an actor. He knew entertainment. He knew the human condition. He knew how to make a story work on film. Especially after he went through Star Trek school for directors. But the gleam in his eye and his ability to, and all the actors talk about this. I was just rereading some of Jerry Flex, the great assistant director that died suddenly, sadly, during Enterprise, but had been around and was Jonathan's AD for his two movies, was talking about that talent that Jonathan had, that at least in the Star Trek world and probably everywhere else he's gone where he's become a regular director, because a lot of the shows he's done since then, he's directed several episodes of. So you can see that it's appreciated there, even if it's not the thing he was birthed in. Like, oh, I was in the cast and I knew everybody already, and now we're just, you know, we get along so well. But it's that ability to make everybody feel good, have a good time, where people didn't dread coming to work, which, you know, should be true of any job. Any good boss or manager, you pray to have that kind of a person in your workspace, not the ones that's, there's the dreary extreme, and then there's the ones that are just, everybody just shows up and ha ha ha, and I talk to you at the company picnic once a year, and, you know, you don't know I'm alive. And apparently, from what everybody says, Jonathan had that extra, that was the icing on the cake for Jonathan. So if there was anything that kind of helped push it along at the beginning, maybe even something he had to overcome at the beginning, you know, like, oh, yeah, you're all smile and laugh, Jonathan, but can you get the work done? And I think once he proved that, yeah, I can not only send everybody home smiling, I can actually get it done. It looks decent, you know, which The Offspring, you know, obviously did. Helps having a great, you know, and then when they're looking for that, when they decide to give somebody a chance, A, they obviously need a script that doesn't have them involved much. So there's the one great scene with Riker and, you know, Lal and Offspring where he gives her a smack. So he got a great, or she gives him a smack. So we got a great moment, but it was one, you know. He's not even, you know, he's hanging around the outside. Because you don't want to wear the space, as they would say, you don't want to have to wear that space suit when you're the rest of the day you're directing. You know, so it's like Leonard directing 4 when he could wear the band and not have to put the ears on in the morning, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But that,
yeah.
I mean, that's in Jonathan's specific case, I think that's what all was going on. And yeah, you're right. But the thing is, they try to find a crucible. They find a test case where they're going to ensure him success. So all that crew that he gets along with, the last thing they want, everybody wants to make it work for Jonathan. He probably even gets a little extra out of all the grips and the crews and the gaffers and the camera crew and the extras. They're probably all rooting for him because they like him so much, you know? And so that helps too. When you come from that, you know, not that that's a requirement, but it's sure a bonus when you're there. And And then on the producer's side, they're going to make, they know that they've got excellent support. You know, they know that Marvin Rush is going to back him up with his camera crew and whoever it was, Rob or Dan's visual effects crew at the time, you know, line was going to back him up on the post side. I mean, they know that everybody's going to be a supportive group for one of their baby taking their first, you know, their first flight. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of learning it coming out of the crucible of the group that you're part of, you know, like a cast member coming out there. Same thing would be like for first ADs, especially who are going to direct, you know. And then David Livingston was a line producer, line producer, was a unit production manager and did the budgets, you know, and he wanted to direct and he got his chance.
Yeah, he directed more episodes than almost anyone in Star Trek.
Yeah. Late Night Livingston. Even though he had that, you know, it's like, oh, great, David. You're like telling us no, when we want something extra for our shows because of budget. And then when you get to direct, it's like, what, a blank check? You know?
But they all have these nicknames. Isn't it Two Takes Frakes? Wasn't that his nickname?
See? Yeah, see, he's efficient. Yeah. Two Takes Frakes, Late Night Livingston. Yeah. There's a really funny picture from Enterprise where they've got a clock. I think it's Jonathan and it's Suzanne Westmore, one of the makeup people, and David and somebody else, and they've got a clock face, and it's like, you know, like 11:20 or something, and they're all pointing at it like, look, David actually got out before midnight. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
But those are the things that are all in play when somebody like Jonathan, and so like he's the best test case, and when he does get a shot, they, you know, the script has to fit, and look, Offspring was a vehicle for Brent, how can you go wrong with Brent? And in a great Data story with, you know, Data involved. I mean, with the Picard involved and all that. So it's like they find the sure thing on everything. The sure thing with the crew, the sure thing with the story and the situation to get them launched well. Because they want them to succeed. It's not like, we're going to make you fail so these damn actors will never raise up and dare to ask to direct again. I mean, that's not what it's about, you know. So
right.
And once he did knock that wall down, then LeVar came along and you know, poor Gates, though, we'll talk about how she thought all the boys got to direct and they finally gave her one show and she did a great job with it.
Yeah. I heard her talking about that last year at the 50th anniversary convention. How she was saying that, like, she was the only one who had experience and she expressed interest in doing it early on, but was, you know, shut out. You know,
and came from a theater, big time theater background. Stage background.
Yeah. So well, that's unfortunate, but yeah. So, okay. You know, he does Offspring. He gets a few more episodes, pretty big one, like Cause and Effect. You know, and eventually, you know,
let's say them real fast. Offspring, okay. Reunion, The Drumhead, which was a little tiny bottle show, but very powerful. And it's all about witch hunting and McCarthyism. Gosh.
Right.
How relevant again. But no, then Cause and Effect, which as a director and a cast was like hell to keep up with to shoot. Just, you know, as a point while you're shooting it live. Now, which one is this? What? How many? I've done it five times. Which way? You know, that comes off beautifully. And then Quality of Life, The Chase, which was fun, Attached. And which was, you know, Big Patrick and Gates, and then Sub Rosa, which everybody loves to now go, oh, my God. But I was reading Jerry Taylor's notes. She was talking about how she, you know, it was her story. She loved gothic romance. She tried to have Janeway's hologram be the gothic, you know, novel. But she was talking about how she loved Sub Rosa, and she thought Jonathan did a great job and had a complete feel for the time and the place and, you know, all that. But then he gets to go over and direct on DS9, and I think that's where those were leading up to The Search Part 2 with the effect. When they could see that it was a TV guy who could deal with effects, that was the big thing. Can you deal with some scope and complexity? If we're leading into his first directing gig, which was First Contact, then who are they going to give it to?
Yeah, Search Part 2, which was basically the second half of the season 2 premiere, right? And then season 3 premiere.
Right.
And then Past Tense Part 2, which is, you know, one of the best episodes of the series. And then, he gets the gig on First Contact, which is huge. Now, I mean, I read the 50-year mission thing, and, you know, they were talking about how, you know, things didn't necessarily go as well as they had hoped with Generations in terms of, you know, David Carson and all that stuff. And they were looking for someone and, you know, various people who you would kind of, would kind of jump to mind, like Colby and stuff like that, were nixed for various reasons.
Yeah.
And then they landed on Frakes. But, like, it seems like there would be a lot of people in between, you know, Carson and Frakes, like, until you get to Frakes, you know what I mean? What was it about Frakes that pushed his name to the top of that list?
I think because he talked about how all the guys put their names in, and a lot of the TV, because they were trying to, you know, was it, to start with, he was kidding somewhere about how once they got past, you know, all the big, some big name directors, he's laughing because they're not going to spend that money on a Trek movie, at least back at that time. You know, the business model for a Trek movie was, what'll the fan base bring in? Now go, you know, 20% beyond, 10% beyond that. But once they, you know, didn't go for Steven Spielberg, they were looking at their better TV. And he said, I had to throw my hat in the ring with everybody else. But they, I think for some of the qualities we talked about, that they thought, and he had proven himself dealing with visual effects, and I think a couple of those had a little bit of scope to them, even for TV episodes. So,
oh, yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. And even, I think part of the thing may have been, like, when he did get a dog, like, what was the reason for it being a little bit of a dog? And I was reading back on, like, the last TV, the last episode of Trek he directed before First Contact was Prototype, the Voyager robot show, which was like disappointing to everybody, including the actor who was cast to be all of it, and he spent the whole show behind a tin mask. And somebody said, it's either Jerry or one of the actors, or one of the people, Brannon, I think, was talking about, oh my God, you know, they were talking about poor Roxanne. She spent 5 days talking to a guy behind a tin mask. And for Jonathan to have brought that off as well as he did. So I think part of the formula there was, even like in hindsight, we go, oh, that wasn't the, you know, it was not the director's fault, but we handed them not the best script in the world, not the best situation in the world. And did they make as much lemonade out of the lemons as they could? And yeah. Cause I think that's part of it. It's not just when everything is going great. It's when things are, you know, it's like any job, when things are not going well, how do you respond and how do you pick up and go? And so Projections was another Voyager that had a lot of, that had Picardo playing for the first time, playing Doc Zimmerman, and there was a lot of, you know, two screen, you know, mirrored projection in that. So even on a TV episode project, and not just, oh, here's a blue screen, we're all staring at ships that are going to be put in, but the human element of visual effects, right? So that was a case of having to deal with humans putting up stuff and dealing with Picardo and stand-ins and all that. So I think all of that weighed in. Past Tense and The Search were both, also another thing was, they were both part twos. So it's not like he went in and did the first end of a show and got to kind of go, aha! He had to come in and match what had been done first and then have his own stamp on it. And Past Tense had, you know, big crowd scenes. He had a lot of extras to deal with there.
And some heavy subject matter as well.
Right.
You know, a lot of like character things, you know, with the actors and stuff, which I guess it makes sense that he would be really good at, since that's, you know, his
and background. Some of the, like Rick, I talked to Rick many times, and they've been on my on speaker CDs too, and he's obviously no longer with us too. He died a couple years ago. But I remember asking him, like, because they talk about a director. And this is another thing about Jonathan. The times I talk to him, he doesn't get off on the analytical. He keeps it pretty, unless you sat down and said, okay, now Jonathan, look me in the face. I want to talk about directing, and I want you to be technical. You know, he can't. He obviously has to know what lenses he's doing and what he's doing, you know, and how he's going to blend this shot into blue screen or whatever. But he keeps the human end of it first. Directors talk about being, are you an actor's director or a techie's director? You know, do you care more about the camera and the shots and the angles than you do about the people and their acting? Or do you come out of stage and you're more of a, you deal with all the actors and their, you know, motivations in the scene work and the script work, and you let the DP behind you deal with what the camera needs to be doing and what's, you know, and blending in with what the CG, you know, what the visual effects guys need and all that kind of thing on a blockbuster. And he was probably good at both.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like,
I think maybe Rick Colby may have, and just to quick that, I think Rick Colby may have been a little bit more of a techie director and dependent on the, he can go up and say, hey, I need more of this from you. But I think he may have leaned more tech way. And I think maybe Jonathan's plus may have been that they thought he was a good fit for both.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's interesting, you know, what you say there, because I just keep on thinking about Frakes' commentary that he does with Sirtis for Insurrection, and the two of them, but you know, Frakes in particular, who made the movie, who obviously was intimately involved with the creation of this movie, he's kind of like, barely remember doing this. I have no idea what's going on here, you know? And that really kind of I mean, I know some of it is just for, you know, for humorous effect or whatever, but I really get the impression that in some, he's not a hoity-toity artist who's like, I am doing Citizen Kane. You know, he's just like,
he's not an auteur.
Exactly. Right. You know, he's doing a job and he's going to do that job exceptionally well. But he's not going to be precious about it, you know, which is probably the ideal, you know, personality for this job, especially a job like this, especially in television. But then, you know, and he does kind of, like you're saying, just is kind of like, whatever, we did this thing. It doesn't matter. Who cares? This is boring. But you look at his movies or his TV shows or whatever, his episodes, and they are much more visually striking than your average episode. Like, he's really good at the visual thing, even though he kind of just, you know, doesn't acknowledge that side of his talent, really, you know? It's interesting. Yeah,
do you think that that's because he didn't go to, a formal film school? Like, he went in and he doesn't have any sort of dogma attached to him for how to move the camera, and so he's willing to play with it and say, oh, I got to do this, to get back to cause and effect. It's like, huh, well, okay, I could do it this way or this way. And he's going to be more willing to sort of break out of the mold and make it. He's going to be aware that somebody is going to need something more relatable to make something like that work.
Well, I think, yes, I think the fact that, and not to be blunt about this, but I think the fact that he came to directing secondarily, and I don't mean here's a paycheck. It's a paycheck, because obviously he cares,
right?
And he's an artist. Yeah. He came through acting as his primary, you know, training. But if you're an actor, you're always being acted by directors on stage or in front of a camera. So it's not like you were a farmer and you came in to be a director. But I think the fact that, like you said, he didn't grow up. He's not like you hear, you know, directors who are techies who are obsessing over lenses and this new gadget and, you know, processes and methods. And that's wonderful. But that wasn't his communication. That wasn't his language. So I think where maybe he's a plus, maybe, you know, we haven't talked about this yet, but his first big First Contact was his first feature credit, and then Insurrection. And then when he kind of took his baby steps outside of Star Trek, so he's done features. So I'm a feature director, you know, on the resume. And his first baby steps out of the Star Trek cradle into the real world and directing, like when Leonard did Three Men and a Baby, was Clockstoppers, I believe. And I never saw it, and I almost tried to see it before we did the show, but it was a kid's movie. It was a time travel thing, so they thought, oh, it'll be great for it. And I know that the powers that be weren't as happy with the outcome. I think it may have been more about the box office than the content. I don't know. But for whatever reason, the important thing was the perception was that that didn't springboard to anything else for him.
I saw Clockstoppers. I mean, I was a projectionist at the time, so I ran it, you know, the night before. But I was like, Clockstoppers, yeah, Jonathan Frakes, you know, I was all excited. That and Thunderbirds. And, you know, Clockstoppers is very solid. You know, I think a lot of people, it was the year after Spy Kids, and I remember him even talking about it. He's like, we've got the Spy Kids weekend. I think it was Good Friday or something like that, that it came out, you know? And I think a lot of people were like, this is going to be this year's Spy Kids. And Spy Kids was an anomaly. You know, it was a crazy hit. And Clockstoppers, though, it's a really solid movie. You know, I would definitely recommend watching Clockstoppers. It works. It totally works.
But see, again, you perception. Know. You know?
Yeah.
You know, look at the cult movies that get rented or get downloaded or get, you know, DVR'd or Netflix all the time. And, you know, the cult movies like Princess Bride, you know, or Office Space. I mean, some of the ones, you know, they were never big at the box office. And Clerks, my God, you know. But the indie movies and all. So, you know, the test of time is one thing. But in the immediacy of people's, you know, the suits and the producers and the money people's memory, that's when you're talking about real time having a job. But now you go back and I was looking at his credits here. So, you know, and there was a time when he, I think, felt like, okay, well, I've blown my wad. I'm a humble guy. And he went back and he taught back home. He went to Maine. He was in New York. He was teaching in college. And then a few years went by and then he came back to Hollywood. And that's, I know there's a video that I did on my blog when we were at the Lightspeed charity thing, the first time I'd ever gone, I guess it was the first time he'd ever gone. And there's like about a 4 or 5 minute chat we have when he had just come back to LA, he and, you know, his wife, Jeannie Francis. And you know, they're both hot, known for something, her on General Hospital, right? Yeah. Luke and Laura. Oh my God. And then, you know, and then dealing with the aging out of that. And then when that goes away, what do you do with yourself? And the last thing you want to do is be a one hit wonder and make yourself feel creative. And, you know, much less eat and pay rent, you know. So finding the ways that careers challenge. And, you know, one thing about the last 10, 15 years of digital age is there's way, way, way more ways for people to do that. There's way more ways for everybody to do that, you know, moi included. Yeah. But that's a thing that's been helpful. But he was just finding his way after thinking, okay, well, Hollywood's, I'm putting words in his mouth. But there's a level of, okay, that's it. I had a good run. Thank you. You know, I'll always have Star Trek conventions, but no actor wants to ever, you know, think their whole life is just going to be going to Star Trek conventions. They want to still be doing worthwhile, you know, they want to show their talent. They want to have an impact on the world. They want to do good things with their intentions. And I, at the time, he thought that was going to be teaching. And thankfully, he came back to L.A. and got into directing. And, you know, I'm just looking here. He directed on, well, Roswell back in the day. And then
he was like the lead director on that thing.
Yeah, well, I'm seeing five episodes there. He did The Librarians. He did those TV movies, that series, and he did a V. But Persons Unknown, I interviewed him for them. It's a lost recording. But he was like, I think he maybe even done the pilot and did some of those when it was trying to. It was a new paradigm of how they made it and sold it. But since then, he did 13 on Leverage, including the one with Brent and Armin, right? It was a kind of a celebrity, you know, but he did 13 on Leverage. He did 3 on Castle, and one of which I did see, called The Fast and the Furious, I think. But it was hysterical because they did one scene especially, and this is where I think his sense of humor, which everybody always talks about, will be famously. And if you go back and watch the blog post I did on Trekland with him, we talked about it in set. But he's got one where, you know, Castle and the two cops, the two main, you know, detectives. They're having to go and they think they're finding a killer and they go and it's an old lady and they're kind of stuck there. So they're already kind of awkward and she makes them sit down and she just old ladies them and she's a crazy cat lady and she's got like a million cats. And there's this hysterical scene where they're all sitting there with their bulletproof vests on her sofa with teacups and there's like cats climbing all over them. And it's just a wonderful, I just remember watching and go, that's the most hysterical image I've seen. And it's like, who's directing this one? Frakes, oh my God. You know, there was no Star Trek, you know, stunt cast. You know, Brent wasn't in it. You know, Marina wasn't in this episode. It was just straight ahead thing. But I just thought, well, you know, when he wants to pull out the whimsy, he sure can. So, you know, he's done several episodes of several other series. So he became a regular that was known to the, he did 5 on Burn Notice. He did an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in 2013. I'm just, you know, looking here. Then he's done 6 on NCIS LA, which freaked him out because they shoot on 8 and 9. And I remember, I remember him talking to me about how it was weird to be walking around on 8 and 9, and they've remodeled it and they've spiffed it up, and it looks way differently than it did when they were there. But I mean, there's planters and plants outside. But that was a weird one. And then he's done some things since then. And
Librarians is his current show, you know, which he he's a producer on as well.
Yeah, The Librarians, right. After doing the TV movies, he's done 8 of these, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's great that he's still working, you know, and I mean, I think, you know, that idea of like him not being sort of like wanting to force his personal style onto things, but, you know, do whatever mm-hmm. is required of him, you know, makes sense when you're a television director. And he seems to be really good at it, especially considering the fact that he's in such high demand, you know?
Yeah.
So it's
yeah,
cool.
I'm sorry. I didn't get back to that point. But what you were saying, John, was what I started to say was exactly when you don't come in with that auteur's, you know, whatever, right. whoop-de-doo, you come in and people appreciate that you don't come in with, I mean, they want you to have a brain and have your own ideas. But when you're willing to be, you know, a changeling, or you're willing to adapt and be a chameleon and come into the family and then put your own stamp on it and go from there without coming in demand. Because that's what TV is. You're the director is the guest guy, not the, you know, movies, you're the lead guy. But in TV, you have to be flexible and come, especially on a series, or else the crew and the cast will quickly let it be known that, you know, we don't need, at least the first time or two, we don't need, you know, stuck up sticky meats here. We,
yeah.
You Python people.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then after a while, but then after you've done one or two or three or four, you have that, just like you would in any situation, when people know you, then you can, you know, you can spread your wings a little bit and maybe do a little bit more, and people appreciate it then, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. It's cool. You know, I mean, who knows what the future holds, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but if he were to come on and direct an episode or two of Discovery, I think that would be pretty awesome, you know? I mean, they're getting everyone else back from the good old days. Why not Frakes as well, you know?
Well, and the good thing is this is a show, since Brian started it, on top of everything else we talk about, what's the concept and the format and who's going to work on it, the other thing is the attitude. And when you have people involved from, you know, who, it's like the new teacher, it's like the new football coach or basketball coach. When they come in, the toughest job in the world is when the guy who was there 40 years retires, or the woman who was there 40 years and retires, or 20 years and was a legend. The hardest thing in the world is coming in for that, because half the time people want to come in and be their own person and, you know, throw all that off and da da da. But the smart people are the ones who come in and they have enough, what's not the word, self-confidence, but they have enough, you know, they have enough ego, that's the good kind of ego, where they can embrace all that, not run away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And when a production crew comes into Discovery embracing, not just giving it lip service, but embracing, you know, with Nick Meyer and with Joe Manosky and Kirsten Beyer, who's way too imbued in the novels and what she's done with, can't, you know, she's, oh, her canon cred is out there. She can't hide it. Like the fans who managed to get hired the first year of Next Generation, or God forbid, even on the first JJ movie. No, I'm not a fan at all. No, I'm not a fan. I'm safe. You know, when they're going to embrace that, then they should be wide open to having Jonathan direct. They're going to make a point of having, you know, the hot directors or the really good quality working directors. But then Jonathan is one. But, you know, but they can appreciate and beyond it just being stunt directing casting, you know.
No, it's not. Yeah, I mean, that's his thing. That's his job. You know, he would be someone who was considered even if he wasn't. You know, I mean, yeah, it seems like a perfect fit to me.
But I mean, Discovery's DNA, production DNA, is not where. Oh no, we don't want any. We obviously know that's not the case. You know, we don't want anyone from the old Star Trek, because they all failed because they all ended. So they're obviously failures. You know. But that attitude, you know, that attitude exists out there. So
sure it does. Yeah. All right. Well, very exciting. Well, so Larry, what have you got going on? You got Portal 47, and
had the first anniversary of Portal 47, and I'll just throw this out there. If anybody's interested in this, I'm about to launch my premium level of Portal 47 called Deck One. But if you don't know about regular Portal 47, it's like a mini con all year long, where no savvy fan's gone before. So even if you're an old fan, new fan, bored fan, or a fan that has no idea how much Star Trek is really still out there that you don't know about, that's what Portal 47's for. And I promise you guys, we are starting to work and edit on Con of Wrath.
All right.
My documentary is happening. And some conventions coming up, and another library tour in Michigan, of all things. You never know. You never know where life's going to go. But, you know, excited, this 30th anniversary of Next Gen, that's happening. Just got come back from the Sci-Fi Ball in the UK. That's great. And if we have any European listeners out there, if I can get back to Portal 47, if I can get 6 Europeans, Brits, Germans, whatever, we will do a special telebriefing session every month just for you all, so it's in your prime time and not 3 in the morning like it would fall now. So portal47.net if you're not familiar with all the goodness of Portal 47. But I'm really happy. I'm really, when people say, my God, I never knew that, or I never knew that person existed, or I had no idea, and all these years of trying to figure out a way to get what I feel like I can bring to Trek better, even though I love being on the podcast, much less conventions and, you know, being interviewed and doing interviews, it all seems like it's in slow motion to me. So, the years are going by, and there's so much that's there, and that's what I enjoy about doing that. That's why Portal 47 is so fulfilling and gratifying to me. And the fact that it's actually like a paying thing on top of that is great too. But I just, it's kind of a new paradigm, and it's kind of interesting to talk about it to people. But once the guys and gals that are in now are wonderful and are evangelizing for me. But, oh, and I need to start reminding everybody this year. It's the off year for our big LA to Vegas Geek Nation Tours film location Trek tour that Geek Nation Tours, Terrace, Cassidy and I do every other year. But this is the year, if you're headed to Vegas anyway, if you're going to Star Trek Las Vegas in August, this is the year that we offer the one-day tour the day before on Con Eve, only it's early in the morning. So about 6-7 hours, we go out to the Valley of Fire, or it's the Kirk Memorial Tour, as I call it. But anyway, that's at the Geek Nation Tours website. If you're interested in that, please give it a look. It's a great way to take a taste of what the big tour is like, or, you know, just add to your Vegas adventure if you're there already. Aside from that, we're working on the doc, and the plan is for me to launch something new at mid-year with a name in Star Trek that you've heard before, but I won't say anything more about it until we get further along with it, but that's the plan. So it was going to be around the time Discovery launched, but who knows when that's going to be, so we're pushing ahead.
Yeah, don't tie yourself down.
Yeah, we're pushing ahead. So that, and I want to give a shout out also to Enterprise in Space, which is the nonprofit that I work with, which is moving along, even though it hasn't had the biggest, for whatever reasons, the biggest profile, but we're applying for grants and a lot of things are moving along, all the technical and all the education reach out, because it's going to put 100 or more students' projects from around the world in orbit on the first real spaceship called Enterprise in 2021 now as a project of the National Space Society. And donations, it's a crowdfunded too, so you can start with $20 and that's at enterpriseinspace.org. It's tax deductible for Americans or whatever amount you give. And and I'll be talking about EIS all this year and summer, as well as whatever else is happening with me. And I've probably forgotten something, but that's okay. My column is still in the paper, Star Trek Magazine, if anybody is still reading that. And I hope you are, because it's still a cool thing.
Oh, yeah. Anytime I see it in the one bookstore which still exists in the city, I'm like, oh, my God. So
it's
yeah,
still there.
Exciting stuff. So if people are looking for you on the internet or whatever, where's the best place to find you?
The hub is still LarryNemechek.com, which launched with a new face a couple months ago. So everybody check that out. Everything else, ConnorRath.com, Portal47.net has their own pages, but you can get to everything at LarryNemechek.com. Or at Larry Nemechek on Twitter. And now, Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Instagram. Yay me for joining the 21st century.
Ooh.
And then Facebook is Larry Nemechek's Trekland. And if you're a collector, Connor, a Trekland trunk is where I put set plans and draft scripts and things out for people to get a hold of. Get them out of my boxes and get them out in the world. On Facebook. Cool. Facebook.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. You know, we always really appreciate it, you know, getting this insight into the making of the Star Trek. And anytime you want to come back, we'd love to have you.
Guys, it's been real. Since Chris has been down and hopefully is going to be back soon with us, it's my Trek FM output has dripped off a little bit, but this has been fun. And like I said, I love what you've done with the place.
Well, that was fun having Larry on to talk about Jonathan Frakes.
I don't know how he keeps everything in his head like that. It's amazing. It is amazing. He is a walking Trek library.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, he really had like the best job in the world, where he basically got to hang out on the sets of Star Trek for like the glory years. I mean, come on.
Yeah. You know,
I've always wanted, because whenever we talk to him, he always drops like some piece of information where I'm just like, wait, what? You know, and it just blows my mind. Like, how did I not hear about that 25 years ago? You know? So I've always thought it would be fun to have him on the show and just be like, okay, Larry, blow our mind. Give us some bit of info about some behind the scenes person who worked on Star Trek that no one has ever heard before, you know?
Yes.
So maybe we can get him on. Maybe we can get him on to do that at some point. So.
Yeah, we'll talk him into it.
Well, it's been fun talking about Jonathan Frakes today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It was kind of a creepy, scary, very intense episode. I really like this episode because it pulls you in and it seems very realistic. And
so you
I
like
love
Mary.
When it does it.
You're a Mary fan.
Yeah, I like
Mary. Mary was one of the ones I was kind of jokingly referencing where it's like, well, you know, if you leave this one out of the rotation, it's not really going to hurt anybody.
Oh, I definitely thought you meant the next one.
No. Well, maybe so.
Earl Grey.
And there's these spooky aliens, and like they look like ferrets, and they're fighting, and like Picard is like possessed by this like thunder and lightning, and the crew are like gonna have a like are gonna go up against him, but they're like, no, we gotta respect the law, man. And it's like that, you know, if you respect the law, someone will end up being a cloud, man, you know.
To the journey.
What would you have done?
Well, I'd have like programmed my tricorder, open the door, lob it in, shut the door quick. Try that first of all.
So you would lob a tricorder probe into the
holodeck. Hope it doesn't break as it lands.
Well, you could wrap it in like some gaffer tape or something.
Some bubble wrap.
The 602 Club.
That feels like a turning point in the movie where they seem to go toward this moral of the story that they even repeated at the end, which is, you know, don't be so busy trying to make a life that you forget to participate in the present of where you are.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We would like to thank our associate producers, Norman C. Lau, Jeff Sutter, and Chris Steftenagel. If you want to be like Norm, Chris, and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com. You can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week by becoming a patron of the network over on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at trekfm or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come up. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. Look for me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, I'm co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing, where we explore some of the stranger aspects of the Star Wars galaxy. And then there's another show that I do on the Nerd Party Network with you, Mike, called Great Shot Kid. Where we explore the work of Star Wars creators, much like we do on this show. So where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me right there, or you can find me on my website, commentarytrackstars.com, where I do commentary track stars. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. So that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to continue the Jonathan Frakes love fest.
Yes.
With a look at his first non-Star Trek movie, Clockstoppers.